Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Laurie Mercier to discuss the 1983 film El Norte. Directed and co-written by Gregory Nava, El Norte is an award-winning, independent, epic U.S. film, notable for centering the experiences of two indigenous Mayan migrants from Guatemala as they move through Mexico and come to work in Los Angeles. El Norte has been included in the U.S. National Film Registry for its historical, cultural, and aesthetic contributions, and the Criterion Collection produced a DVD version with director's commentary and other special features. The story is divided in three parts. The first takes place in Guatemala and follows the indigenous family. The father, Arturo, is killed by the army because of his organizing with fellow coffee plantation workers. The mother and most of the village is rounded up by the army, and the children, Enrique and Rosa, flee to the north. The second part takes place in Mexico as Enrique and Rosa migrate north and find a coyote to take them across the U.S. border. The last part takes place in Los Angeles and follows Enrique and Rosa as they find work, she in a sweatshop and then as a house cleaner, he in a restaurant and then as a day laborer. Lori, you're an historian and you've included this film in courses that you've taught. Let's start by reviewing the historical context of the film and what was happening in Guatemala and the U.S. when it was made in the early 1980s.
Well, the violence in Guatemala that we see hints of in the film as Enrique and Rosa are forced to flee really originates in 1954 when the United States and CIA engineered a military coup against the democratically elected president of Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz. Arbenz had threatened corporate interests due to his modest proposals to increase wages and enact land reform. After the coup, for the next 30 years, the United States continued to supply the Guatemalan military regimes with funds, equipment, and training, resulting in brutal state repression, displacement, and poverty. So in the 1980s, when the film is made, the Reagan administration had intervened to crush social movements that had arisen to protest this brutality. And the U.S.-backed Guatemalan military swept through indigenous communities, committing over 600 massacres. As the genocide unfolded, the Reagan administration continued to push for funding, and tens of thousands of mostly indigenous Guatemalans fled north. So this is when the filmmaker Gregory Nava met dozens of survivors of one of the massacres at Huehuetenango, who had sought refuge in a Los Angeles church. And he did interviews with these refugees and lots of research. And so that provides the backdrop for the film. Ultimately, the United Nations Commission for Historical Clarification reported that from 1960 to 1996, the U.S.-funded Guatemalan Civil War resulted in the deaths of over 200,000 people. And the vast majority of them were Mayan. The state and paramilitary forces committed 93% of human rights violations with a complete scorched earth policy, which ended up displacing almost half the population of Guatemala. And I could recommend to listeners the Digital National Security Archive online. It's a great resource, which actually has the declassified documents about this U.S. intervention and aiding and abetting the violence in Guatemala. And Fran, I find one of the most important elements of the film is that it reveals how migration then and now from the South is directly due to U.S. actions, whether it's supporting dictators and brutal militaries in Guatemala in the 80s or today the crushing sanctions on countries like Venezuela and Cuba. And throughout the decades, the system of global capitalism that forces workers and farmers to move in order to survive. So, Fran, what did you find most compelling about El Norte?
There are so many very compelling things about this film. I first saw it when it came out 40 years ago, and having not seen it again until recently, there are still scenes seared into my memory. It's quite a striking and memorable film. Nava, as you say, developed it in conjunction with Guatemalan immigrants who he met in California. He had grown up on the border in California from a Mexican-American family and had relatives on both sides. And initially, he wanted to make this film that would humanize immigrants. And initially, it was going to be about Mexican immigrants in order to humanize the immigrants who were providing so much of the labor on which Americans depended, but who were not necessarily seen, who weren't recognized as people. But then he met all of these Guatemalan immigrants and learned more about that story. And so he pushed the story further back, both further south into Guatemala, where there was this, all of these massacres ultimately recognized as a genocide funded and fueled by the United States, but also back into indigenous experience. The story also draws on imagery from the Popol Vuh, the pre-Columbian Mayan epic that has dual protagonists. The main characters in that are twins. There's a lot of sun and moon imagery. There's a lot of circular imagery. So he's drawing on a wealth of cultural references that go back before the invasion of the Americas, but also drawing on, you know, work by Diego Rivera and other artists.
And the magical realism of Latin American writers.
Yes, the dream realism he talks about in the commentary on the film. There are some sort of magical moments, especially in the first part of the film, where it's not, there isn't a distinguishing between dream and waking. Everything sort of blends together smoothly. There's a scene where Rosa comes into her house and the house is filled with white butterflies, which are a symbol of death. And it's just a very beautiful image. And there's no reason to think that it's not real, except that it's a weird thing to have that many white butterflies in a house. But it's not separated off. And then later on, some of the more surreal and dreamlike imagery is more clearly distinguished as happening in the character's dreams rather than in waking life. And waking life becomes much more cold and much less beautiful. And the scenes, especially at the beginning, are quite beautiful. And that is something that Nava has also talked about, the importance of lighting things properly for people with brown skin. And I think of also the filmmaker Julie Dash, who made Daughters of the Dust, having talked about the importance of using a different kind of lighting technique when you're filming black skin, or in the case of El Norte, when you're filming olive-toned and brown skin, that the kinds of lighting techniques developed for white people just don't work as well when you're looking at people with darker skin. And so, I mean, there are sort of subtle things like that that really add to the beauty of the film. So some of that is I think really important and part of the aesthetic and emotional experience of the film. It brings us much closer to the characters.
You know, now that you mention it, it seems like the beginning of the film that's set in Guatemala is more dreamlike and the lighting is much different than when Rosa and Enrique are traveling north through Mexico and then to the United States, where the lighting becomes more harsh, symbolizing the cold reality of the capitalism in the El Norte, which requires a much more brutal form of labor than the scenes from picking coffee in Guatemala.
Yes.
I mean, which also had its own brutality, but clearly the filmmaker is trying to make this distinction between the different places that they travel and exist.
And yet there are also these parallels, visually and conceptually, right? That the whole film is taking place within the circuits of capitalist labor relations. There's a real strong parallel in the composition and the framing of early scenes when Enrique and his father are picking coffee on the plantation under the eye of the foreman. And then a later scene when Enrique is working on a construction site in Los Angeles and he's digging a ditch. And again, he's lined up with other workers and he's under the eye of a foreman. And there's a kind of return to the same set of relations, although not in this beautiful setting that his father tells him early in the film, you know, this is good land. And that's why they've taken it, because it's good land. So, I mean, there are differences, but there are also these parallels from what happens at the beginning and what happens later, because it's all happening in relation to capitalist exploitation of the poor, of the workers. whether they're picking coffee or digging ditches.
The other strong features of the film I find is that, the ending is not a happy one. In contrast to so many rags to riches immigrant stories in American literature and what few films exist about the immigrant stories. But the film clearly is making this commentary on the violence at the heart of American capitalism. And, that may remains today one of the strong features of the film about how the bosses, whether the woman who's hiring domestics or the restaurant owner or the textile executive with their global system of sweatshops, they might be clueless or arrogant and privileged, but they hold the lives of Enrique and Rosa in their hands, creating this tension through the film that also has relevance today. It's familiar to all of those going through their own migrant or immigrant experience today.
Yeah, the film really doesn't buy into the illusory sort of rags to riches story, just as it doesn't give us an Anglo protagonist. In trying to fund the film, one of the offers they got was basically if you had an Anglo star, which is how most such stories had been framed, right? The white reporter who comes in and exposes the terrible experiences of the suffering masses. Whereas here, it's the immigrants themselves. We don't need the intermediary figure of the white savior, white reporter figure. And it's striking that ultimately the film was partly funded by, I mean, this is another marker of how much things have changed, but it was partly funded by PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which I don't think is likely to fund anything like it these days. So, I mean, times have really changed, and not for the better.
But I think the filmmakers did have, they did struggle with funding, and they did have to make a few compromises, not to be explicitly critical of the US role in the genocide or in the agribusiness in Guatemala. And I think that points to this continuity between, any film today or then that tries to make a serious critique runs into trouble not only with fundraising, but in distribution. And initially, this film had difficulty finding a distributor, just as current films, including the documentary winner of the Academy Award, the Palestine film, that has still not been able to find a distributor in the United States. So, clearly, this is a reminder about how film in the United States is limited by, again, these capitalist forces that determine what we see, what stories are elevated and which are hidden or censored. Do we want to say something, Fran, about how the border crossing has changed since the 1980s? I mean, it seems important just since Trump recently made it practically impossible for migrants who arrive at the border to obtain any kind of asylum. This was the case in the 1980s as 1 million Salvadorans and Guatemalans came to the United States fleeing the violence that the United States was supporting, and only 2% of them received asylum. But there was this social movement in the United States, the sanctuary movement, the anti-war movement against Reagan's policies in Central America that resulted in the Boland Amendment, and also the 1986 immigration law that did grant asylum to Central American refugees. I mean, what do we see as different today than the 1980s and efforts to migrate north?
There are many, many differences. The characters in the film enter the US ultimately by crawling through a tunnel, and that is a detail that Nava learned of from someone who had done that, had entered the country by crawling through one of these abandoned tunnels, which after the film got blocked up so that no one could get in that way. There are scenes of the border fence in the film. It was a chain link fence with some barbed wire on top, much easier to get through than the kind of apparatus that's there now. And I think maybe most striking, the INS and the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the Border Patrol cooperated with the filmmakers in making this movie because they wanted to improve their image. They were a little worried that people thought they weren't humane enough, which is clearly not a worry that their successor organizations have at this point. But they just said, well, don't show a drawn gun when they're being arrested by INS. And they actually filmed inside an INS facility where they're being interviewed before they're sent back. They're sent back to Mexico because someone has given them the advice to pretend to be Mexican, so they're not sent all the way back to Guatemala. So they have to learn to curse like Mexicans. And that works. But it's an awful experience for them coming north, and yet it's clearly much worse now for people who are trying to make that kind of journey.
Something else I might mention, I can't resist, is just how we see in the 1980s, even though the Republicans were in dominance, the Democratic Party seemed to have more of a backbone. And we see this in 1984 with the Reagan-Walter Mondale debate, where Mondale actually criticized Reagan and questioned him about his Central American policies that were killing so many people in Central America. So it's hard to imagine. I mean, now the Democratic Party seems to be the party of war, just like the Republican Party, and, not advocating for immigrants like many in the Democratic Party were back in the 1980s. So I would see that as another change. So, Fran, where can people access this film?
Well, it's available to rent on several streaming sites, and you can browse around depending on which ones you have access to. You can stream it for free on the Internet Archive, although it doesn't have subtitles, so you kind of need to know Spanish and Quiché as well as English in order to understand the film from that venue. And it's available on DVD at the Multnomah County Library, and they have the Criterion Edition with all the bells and whistles and beautiful digital transfer. So you can get it at the library, you can find it online. It's really worth finding. It's a beautiful film. It has funny moments and it's very moving, and it's historically, culturally, aesthetically significant and important and relevant still today.
Absolutely relevant 40 years later. So we highly recommend that listeners go out and find El Norte. Even if you saw it 40 years ago, it's worth seeing again, especially this new Criterion version that Fran described. And this is Laurie Mercier and Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Recommending El Norte.